Welcome, everybody. I'm Dr. Anu, co-host of the Hormone Super Conference. And today I'm joined by Fionnuala Barton. Dr. Fionnuala is a GP and she's also a British Menopause Society registered practitioner. She is passionate about educating women about making informed choices when it comes to perimenopause and menopause. Welcome, Fionnuala.
Hello. Thank you, Anu. Thank you ever so much for having me. It's a real pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much. So tell us, let's start with the basics and the terms. What actually is perimenopause versus postmenopause?
I think that's a really great place to start because getting our definitions right can really help us to understand what we're going through and therefore what options we've got available to us. And as a starting point, menopause is defined as the point at which we haven't had a period naturally for 12 months. So it's actually a finite point in time, one day in your life where it has been 12 months since the last period. Now, of course, this isn't always abundantly clear if you have been using forms of contraception, for example, that stop you from bleeding, or if you've had surgical procedures that mean that you don't bleed on a regular basis, then it can sometimes be tricky to work that out exactly. But ultimately, that's where the point of menopause is. Any time after that is often described as menopause or postmenopause after the point of menopause. And this is when we have essentially very persistently low levels of those important ovarian sex hormones because the ovaries have come to the end of their ovarian potential and are no longer producing those sex hormones in sufficient quantities. Then we have perimenopause, and this is a relatively new term, actually, that has, you know, been coined relatively recently and is gaining a lot of attention. And that's because it's this phase that is often most difficult for many women. This represents the period of time in the run-up to the point of menopause. And so for that reason, it can be pretty ill-defined, it can be pretty non-specific, it can be difficult to pinpoint and can represent quite a troublesome diagnostic uncertainty. And it can be really turbulent. Some women, I think on average, will experience perimenopause for between 2 to 6 or 8 years before the point of menopause. But actually, we know that some women might experience perimenopausal symptoms for almost up to 15 years before their actual point of menopause. The reason for this is the underlying biological changes. So as I've mentioned, at menopause, the ovaries have no longer got follicles left to ovulate. Therefore, we're not producing those important sex hormones at all from the ovaries. In perimenopause, women may still be ovulating on a regular basis or indeed ovulating on an irregular basis. So this means that they are still having cyclical changes, but that they might be irregular cyclical changes. But in those cycles, they might be producing insufficient amounts of the necessary hormones to support normal cellular function in the body. And when we think about our sex hormones, estrogen, testosterone, and progesterone, the cells of our body have been reliant on these three important hormones for normal function for most women decades between the point of them starting their periods in puberty to then the point of their periods ending at menopause. And of course, if the cells of the body that have been using those hormones to date no longer have sufficient amounts of them, or indeed have excessive amounts of those hormones swinging around, then sometimes it can wreak havoc. And often there is a crescendo. As you sort of start in perimenopause, things can start to become a little bit uneasy. And then as you move through perimenopause to the point of menopause, things can often get considerably worse before they start to settle postmenopausally, or certainly that's my experience clinically.
Fantastic. So what might people experience in terms of symptoms in each of these three different phases?
So, you know, as mentioned, these three important sex hormones, hormones by definition are chemicals produced in the body that have an impact throughout the body. They're produced in one organ but have an impact throughout the body. And we've got loads and loads of these hormone systems in the body, and all of those hormone systems interact. So it makes it quite a complicated picture. And it's very easy to be overly simplistic about the changes that occur during perimenopause and menopause. But it's important to stand back from that and appreciate that these changes in the sex hormones have actually got impacts on other hormone systems as well. Not just that, as I've mentioned, all the cells of our body are using these important hormones to enable normal cellular function throughout our reproductive years. And so when these levels start to fluctuate, change, or decrease during perimenopause, we experience symptoms from head to toe that may be heightened or may be reduced due to changes in cellular function. Postmenopausally, when those levels of hormones are persistently low, then that's when we see kind of a persistent low level of activity in the cells that have previously relied on these hormones. And so just to summarize, really, you can get symptoms in the central nervous system. So you can experience headaches, you can experience mood changes, cognitive dysfunction, commonly called brain fog, which might manifest as difficulty concentrating, a sense of easy overwhelm, problems with memory, recall, word finding is really common, difficulties, executing complex tasks or forward planning in many ways. You can also experience low mood, sometimes without obvious reason, anxiety, swings in mood. So you might feel absolutely fine one day and then feel absolutely awful the next. And this is what can be so discombobulating, to say the least. Panic attacks are quite common, as parts of the brain responsible for our emotional response have got different levels of hormones regulating them. Then we can see changes to things like our eyes can get dry, our vision can start to change. Estrogen is a very potent hydrator and anti-inflammatory. So if you lose hydration in the eye, it can give rise to a number of symptoms. Equally in the mouth and in the entire gastrointestinal tract. You know, these hormones have an important regulatory function in terms of making sure our gut microbiome stays in decent balance, but also our gut mucosa is working well. And if our microbiome goes out of whack or our mucosa aren't working very well, we're much more likely to experience symptoms like gut sensitivities to new foods, leaky gut symptoms, bloating, change in bowel habit, these kind of things, which again are a really common complaint, both in perimenopause when things are chaotic, but also postmenopausally. We can experience symptoms in our cardiovascular system. So estrogen, as I've mentioned, is a potent anti-inflammatory. It's also very useful for maintaining normal levels of cholesterol in the bloodstream, and it's a useful relaxant. So it helps to maintain good blood pressure and it helps to reduce cardiovascular risk. It's also important in terms of regulating rhythm in the heart, etc. And so when levels are fluctuating, women might see palpitations experiencing, or they might start to experience sort of chest discomfort symptoms. They may see an increase in their risk of cardiovascular disease, or their blood pressure might start to go up. We've then got symptoms in our joints. Joint pain is an incredibly common symptom, and often it's persistent joint pain postmenopausally, and it might be intermittent joint pain during the perimenopausal years. It's often associated with swelling or stiffness, and can often impact a person's ability to enjoy their life, enjoy the activities that they've usually been doing, fulfill their work obligations or complete tasks at home, which in turn can have a massive impact on how we feel and our self-esteem and our worth, et cetera, et cetera. So there's all these kind of complex links moving together. Skin is one of our biggest immune organs, and having healthy skin is a really important part of our immune system. It's also a really important part of our identity and who we are and how we present ourselves to the world. And when we've got fluctuant levels of hormones in perimenopause and deficient levels of hormones postmenopause, we see a profound number of skin changes as well as hair changes. So we're more prone to acne or rosacea, which is this sort of inflammation to the skin. The skin gets dry, it gets dehydrated, we get more water loss from the surface of the skin, we get more inflammation, we're more prone to dermatitis and eczema and those kind of skin conditions, which can be really tricky to sort of keep tabs on. And of course, like I said a moment ago, then the impact of that, not only is it disruptive to your skin and your immune system, but can have a profound knock-on effect on your confidence and your self-esteem. I could go on. There are literally symptoms that you might get anywhere in the body. You put an arrow anywhere on the body and you can pretty much think of a symptom that might start there. One of the other ones that I feel quite passionately about is this sort of, as well as brain function, central nervous system function. So we rely on our central nervous system to keep us kind of integrated in the world, doing things normally, perceiving things, interacting, responding, etc. sometimes in perimenopause, if hormones are fluctuant and they're having a knock-on effect on our neurotransmitter levels, these are the chemicals that are firing messages around our nervous system, then that can have a profound effect. And we can start to see sort of problems manifesting as a result of that. And I think we're going to dig into that in a little bit more detail later on.
So much, isn't there? There's so much going on underneath the surface, and exactly. You touched on so many points. I mean, I'm just going to ask you about two more, which I think are such big ones for women, osteoporosis and weight. What would you say about those two?
So I think these are both really important points, actually. The one thing I didn't even mention there was it's a multi-system situation because of the nature of the underlying issue. And of course, many women will experience menstrual changes because of the impact of those hormones changing on the endometrium and the fact that they may be ovulating or they may be not ovulating, and after menopause they're not ovulating at all. So that is something that's important to bear in mind. And one of the myths around perimenopause is that if you're still having regular periods, you can't be in perimenopause. And I would just say that that's not true. You can be perimenopausal with having regular periods still, because you might just not be mounting the same hormone response with each cycle. So just in answer to the question, or your point about weight and osteoporosis, I'll take them one by one if that's okay. So if you're at a stage where you're experiencing symptoms that you think might be due to underlying sex hormone changes, then you're perceiving something that's happening in your body. So it's obviously at a level that it is perceptible. There are a number of changes that are happening with these hormone fluctuations that are imperceptible. And these are changes happening to your bone mineral density and in many ways to your cardiovascular system. You're not going to feel your blood pressure increasing. You're not going to feel cholesterol being laid down in your blood vessels. You're not going to feel a change in your bone mineral density. But if you're experiencing symptoms, it's likely that you are also experiencing changes on a cellular level in these two important systems, which may increase your risk of having lower bone mineral density, which increases your risk of osteopenia and osteoporosis, which are two conditions that will increase your risk of fracturing if you fall. And that doesn't necessarily sound like a big deal to a lot of people, but if you're living a dynamic, busy, chaotic life, you fall over and you break your hip, you're out of action for several weeks, and you might never fully recover normal function again. It can be devastating, not just hips, you know, fingers, toes, wrists. The number of people I speak to who've sort of stubbed a toe and it's broken because, you know, we're just at this stage in our lives. And it does take you out of action for a considerable amount of time. And we know that having normal hormone levels is really important for good bone mineral density. What's also really important for good bone mineral density, though, is a diet that's rich in calcium, is adequate vitamin D levels, which we don't very much get from dietary sources. We more often get our vitamin D through sunlight exposure to the skin. And the research indicates that we need about 10 to 15 minutes per day with head, neck and arms in the sun to the extent that they feel warm to get adequate vitamin D levels naturally. But of course, in many places in the world, that's not feasible on a daily basis, particularly in the UK in winter and in many other places across the world. But also we have to be mindful of our skin cancer risk. So a lot of people have got SPF all over their skin whenever they go out in sunlight to avoid the risks of aging from the sun or from skin cancer from the sun. And culturally, there's a lot of people who don't wish to show their skin. Or actually, if you're somebody who is ultimately relatively housebound for whatever reason and you don't get the chance to leave the house very often, those people are also at increased risk. So vitamin D is really, really important. And if you're at an at-risk group, as well as being in perimenopause or menopause, vitamin D supplementation is something that I would really highly recommend for people. Weight bearing activity is the other really important key element of good bone mineral density and reducing osteoporosis risk. And this can be completely free. It just involves doing something and moving on a regular basis that is putting weight through your joints in different ways in order to sort of trigger bone regeneration ultimately. And this is something that in our modern day lives, people often lack. You might get up in the dark, drive to work in the dark, sit at your desk in the dark all day, get stressed, go home, eat dinner, and then sit on the sofa watch TV and then maybe go to bed. And actually that kind of a day isn't unusual. And in that kind of a day, you're not doing enough weight bearing activity in order to maintain normal bone mineral density. So it's a really, again, it's accessible, it's important, alongside whatever other strategies you use at this stage of life. Weight. I mean, we could talk for a whole hour just about weight. So gaining weight in midlife is normal. It is a normal part of aging. It's not necessarily favorable for us in terms of our health and well-being. And in many cultures, it's not deemed to be, you know, something to aim towards, gaining weight. You know, I think our culture now very much celebrates not being overweight, which is fine because we know that having a normal body weight is actually conducive to lower rates of metabolic diseases like type 2 diabetes, lower rates of immune and inflammatory diseases, lower rates of cancers, and also lower rates of things like cardiovascular and cerebrovascular disease. So we know that it's better for us not to gain weight, but aging means that we tend to. And we have an opportunity at this phase of life in perimenopause if we start to notice that it's different managing our weight to how it used to be, we might need to make some changes. And the reason that we do start to gain weight as women during this phase is actually quite clever. In many ways, it's your body's adaptation to changing hormone levels. So your hormone levels are changing and your body is saying, actually, we don't have as much of these ovarian hormones hanging around anymore because the ovaries aren't working so well. I know what I'll do. I will upregulate fat cell production because fat cells can produce things like estrogens and testosterones. And so it's actually a very clever adaptation, but it's not necessarily advantageous for us in the long term. Those fat cells tend to be deposited around our intra-abdominal organs, sometimes called visceral fat, but also in our intra-abdominal and under our intra-abdominal skin. So we tend to see this sort of central weight gain, this sort of belly developing. And it can be very difficult to lose that if it sort of piles on and piles on and piles on without adequate action. And there aren't any hard and fast solutions to it. But I think it's something that's really important that people are alert to. And it can be really subtle. Like I've mentioned, perimenopause can happen insidiously. It can happen subtly. And actually, it relies on people just being alert to all the different things that might point towards this change happening under the surface in order that you can pause and actually say, well, what can I do proactively to help maintain good health at this stage of my life? And part of that is going to be strategies in order to maintain weight. There's a lot of, you know, different strategies that you can use. What I would say is everybody is individual, and some things will work brilliantly for some women and some things will not work brilliantly for others. And it's about finding what works well for you within the confines of your lifestyle. Very easy for me to wax lyrical about a healthy diet, exercising 5 times a week and thinking about intermittent fasting and cutting out alcohol. But a lot of the pressures that we live under currently mean that women aren't able to access even those, you know, basic changes. So that hasn't necessarily answered the question specifically, but I hope it's been a good kind of pause for thought, I suppose, about the weight issue.
I loved that description of, you know, the body trying to help by conserving fat, to which because the fat estrogen cells can make estrogen. Yeah. And certainly some women find, when they're replacing their hormones, if they get that balance right, that can help their weight shift. Yeah. You mentioned a bit earlier about myths. One of the myths being that if someone's having regular periods, it doesn't necessarily mean that they can't be in perimenopause. What other myths do you commonly come across?
So I think one of the ones that I come across very frequently as a relatively young woman in perimenopause, working in the menopause and perimenopause space, is you're too young. And this infuriates me for so many reasons. As I've mentioned, actually perimenopause can start up to 15 years before the point of menopause. Average age of menopause is around 52 or 50 to 52, but actually that might be coming down as, you know, population studies suggest that for whatever reason that average age is starting to come a little bit lower. Part of the underlying biology of perimenopause is this change in ovarian reserve. Now, we are born with a finite ovarian reserve. And from the point that we start, well, from the point that we're born, we start losing follicles from the ovaries. And then from the point that we start having periods, we're losing quite a few follicles on a monthly basis throughout our reproductive years. And at some point, we start to lose those at a slightly accelerated rate. And that tends to be in around our 30s, which is why we are told that our ovarian reserve and our fertility starts to decline quite dramatically from our 30s onwards. So it stands to reason that if it's the same biological issue underlying the change in fertility in our 30s as it is the change in hormone levels in perimenopause, I think this is something that women in their 30s need to be aware of and need to be thinking about, how can I proactively identify and then manage this situation. I've got plenty of patients who come through clinic who have gone to their doctors with a myriad of symptoms, and quite rightly, they have explored what other issues might have given rise to those symptoms. As I said, it's a multi-system issue, so it's really important to rule out other causes of all of these symptoms. But if all of those tests are negative, they've then been told, well, you're too young to be perimenopausal, or you're too young to have HRT. And this is one of the myths that really, really gets to me, because there is no such thing as too young to be concerned and to be proactively managing your hormone health, particularly as we know when hormone levels are declining, we see an increase in our cardiovascular disease risk and increase in our osteoporosis risk. Also, there is more and more evidence building to suggest that declining sex hormone levels also increases inflammation and has an impact on our metabolic health. Two big areas of disease that can cause untold problems as we age. And so it is something that I feel really passionately about proactively looking at. And the solutions, as I said earlier, are all going to be different for different people. I think this is also a really useful point to talk about slightly different forms of menopause. So there is something called premature ovarian insufficiency, historically called premature menopause. And this can happen very frequently to women of any age. And I have teenage patients who have premature ovarian insufficiency. So their periods either started and then stopped within a few years, or their periods never started. And so this is something that affects women of any age. One in 100 women under the age of 40 will experience premature ovarian insufficiency or premature menopause. 1 in 1,000 women under the age of 30. These are big numbers. And so it's important that we're all open to this as a possibility as clinicians, and that patients and women are aware that this might be something going on in their lives too. The other specific type of menopause are medical and surgical menopause. And of course, these can happen at any time also. If you've had lymphoma and you've had to have chemotherapy and radiotherapy for that, or any other type of cancer treatment, that can have a significant effect on your ovarian reserve and your ovarian function moving forward. If you've had a disease, a gynecological problem that has necessitated a hysterectomy and oophorectomy, where the ovaries have been surgically removed from the body, you are instantly plunged into the depths of profound menopause. And that happens at any age for a whole range of reasons. So again, there's no such thing as too young. And actually, on the point of surgical menopause, patients who are facing an oophorectomy need to talk to their clinicians and their surgeons. What hormone therapy am I going to be on? And am I going to be on it immediately post-op? And do I need to be on high doses? Because actually, these are really important elements of how they're going to recover from that surgical procedure. Women who have an early menopause or a surgical menopause, who are using hormone replacement therapy or menopause or hormone therapy, are advised to stay on that therapy until at least the average age of menopause, so that they are not losing out and a disadvantage to those people who haven't gone through that early. Does that make sense?
This is such a helpful point to be flagging up, because yeah, a lot of the, obviously the debate, the talk about menopause is, you know, when the periods naturally end, and there's sometimes this sense of, oh, but isn't it a natural ending? Sure. And what you're putting attention on is quite how common it is, or how common it can be, for menopause to happen so much younger, and at that time that menopause is a real issue and it has to be treated and addressed properly. So thank you for that myth buster. That's incredibly helpful.
One I just wanted to add, actually, yeah, that I won't go into quite so much detail on, is that you are too old. So another problem I see in clinic very frequently is, I'm 60, I had HRT for a couple of years, but was told I needed to stop it because it was risky. You know, am I too old? Is it too late? And the answer to that question is no. women of any age can be considered for hormone replacement therapy or menopausal hormone therapy for management of symptoms on an individualized basis. And we need to take into account the benefits of medical treatment versus the risks. And so that is something that is very, very individualized. And this is something that has changed recently. What we know is that post-menopause, when our cardiovascular disease risk increases as our hormone levels are low, we have about a 10-year window of opportunity to optimize cardiovascular disease risk by initiating HRT. So if you've got somebody who actually had their menopause at 55 and comes to you age 60 saying, actually, I'd quite like to consider HRT, it's actually in their interest, even if they haven't got a huge number of symptoms, because it's going to help with their cardiovascular risk, which is a huge risk for women, you know, in general. Even outside of that 10-year window of opportunity, there is still advantages for some women to be using hormone replacement therapy, or to at the very least be considering proactive management of these issues. And even if it's not systemic hormones, sometimes things like vaginal estrogen or vaginal DHEA, for example, can be really helpful at improving pelvic health symptoms as we age, which reduce our risk of cystitis and UTI. And as you probably know, UTI is really common as we get older. Sepsis from urinary tract infections is really common as we get older, and it can be profoundly difficult, and it can actually be very dangerous for women as we get older. So, you know, there is no such thing as too old either.
Fantastic. So if women are doing well on their hormones, you know, there's no arbitrary time that they need to stop. Earlier on, you mentioned the nervous system and that related to hormone changes. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes. So as I mentioned, our sex hormone system, as all of our hormone systems, are interconnected. And one of the other hormone systems that our sex hormone system is connected intricately with is our stress hormone system. So we often call our reproductive hormonal system the HPG, or hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis. There's also the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, or HPA, and it's that system that kind of governs our stress response. And the two communicate really closely and interact and affect each other really closely. And a sort of example of this is, you know, we haven't quite evolved out of this stress response. Having stress response is very normal. It's protective. It helps us to avoid danger and get out of harm's way. When we see something that is stressful, we mount a biological stress response. We have adrenaline and cortisol and other hormones flying through our system in order to fight, freeze, flee, or get to safety. And that's what prevented us from being eaten by tigers when we were cave people. Via this same process, when our stress hormones are high, that messages to our sex hormone axis that it now might not be a great time to fall pregnant or to carry a young child. So actually, high stress hormone levels directly impact the part of the brain that then control ovulation. And sometimes we see a downregulation in ovulation in times of stress. So for example, in times of famine, often women will stop having periods because it's not going to be, evolutionarily advantageous for them to be pregnant or have a small child at that time. And we haven't evolved out of this important evolutionary sort of primitive reflex, and our modern day lives constantly switched on, constantly being exposed to things with super high expectations of ourselves. You know, women have been told that we can do everything, and not only do everything, we can do everything brilliantly, and actually it's really hard. And if our stress hormone levels are constantly switched on and we're firing off all these stress hormones, which in turn are having an impact on our neurotransmitters, the chemicals controlling our nervous system, then it can have a direct impact on our sex hormone levels and vice versa. So we see this sort of interplay between the two systems. We know that our sex hormones are really important for producing sufficient amounts of important neurotransmitters, things like serotonin, noradrenaline, and dopamine, to name a couple. And so if our sex hormone levels are out of whack, we don't necessarily produce these neurotransmitters as effectively, or we don't sort of help these neurotransmitters work as effectively. And that can manifest in central nervous system dysfunction. In the same way that when we're stressed, we might feel pins and needles, we might feel jittery, we might experience headaches or mood changes or cognitive dysfunction. The sex hormone changes can really contribute to that. And if you're somebody who has a predisposition to having a slightly jangled nervous system, so if, for example, you're what might be termed sensory sensitive, for example, or if you're, you know, somewhere on the neurodiversity spectrum whereby you are more sensitive to certain things, those fluctuations in sex hormones during perimenopause and then the frank deficiency of those hormones either after natural menopause or medical or surgical menopause can have a profound effect on the way that your nervous system works. And I see this quite commonly in the clinical setting. Currently there is a big discussion around ADHD, and in particular undiagnosed adult female ADHD, because women generally are very good at masking things like ADHD symptoms. And a lot of women are coming to clinic in perimenopause with a lot of these central nervous system symptoms: overwhelm, anxiety, insomnia, difficulty regulating emotions, etc., a whole myriad of them. And there's a real overlap. And the HRT that we often prescribe helps. The lifestyle changes that I often recommend help. But often there's something else that isn't quite, you know, going to plan. And in these women, often they've gone on to then, you know, go in and seek an ADHD or a neurodiversity sort of diagnosis, which helps them to explain why things might have been a little bit harder for them. And so I'm really interested in this kind of interplay between our hormone system and our central nervous system. And, you know, even if you don't seek therapeutic or pharmacological interventions for these issues, what's really important is that you start listening to your body and you start listening to the messages that your body is giving you. And actually, if you're feeling overwhelmed, if you're physically jangled, if you're not sleeping, and if you're, you know, experiencing distress as a result of all of this, it's your body trying to tell you that it's not coping and something needs to give. And a lot of that is going to be resting. It's going to be working with your nervous system, not against it. And as I said, in a world where we are constantly switched on, exposed and expected to do, you know, and be, and all of these things, actually it can be really hard to stop and to pause and to say, this isn't working for me. I need to do things slightly differently. And I really encourage as many of my patients to do that as possible. One of the easiest ways is to get out in nature, is to start connecting with the breath, and actually learning to breathe again properly, because a lot of us don't do that very well. And actually really prioritizing calm, ease, and rest, which have a positive effect on our nervous systems, which in turn will reduce the stress response and potentially have a positive impact on hormones and vice versa.
That's a fantastic link about the association between hormones and hormone imbalances and neurodiversity, because I think that's just another tool in there for people to address what's becoming an increasingly common diagnosis.
Mm. And the women I see are often less supporting a child who's had a diagnosis, and it's been really hard because their child has been challenging. And that's okay but it's okay to find things hard. And they've noticed that actually there are traits that they're seeing in their child who's then subsequently had a diagnosis, and they think, goodness me, actually this is something that reminds me of me when I was a child. And often it's through that lens that then it's useful to start thinking about how we can support our own central nervous systems and, you know, seek a diagnosis if that's what's, you know, useful.
And you've touched on so many of the lifestyle things or the struggles that people are having in their real lives when dealing with hormone imbalances. I mean, in your experience, what kind of situations do you see women come in with?
Oh, everything. I think this is why I love my job. I see women from all different walks of life, who've got very different backgrounds, who've got different ethnicities, who've had different challenges, who've had different reproductive journeys, and who are in different circumstances now, who also have a whole variety of different beliefs and feelings and thoughts about their experience and where they want to be going. There is just a huge breadth of experiences, and no two women are going to have the same experience, which is a big reason why there's no way we can ever say this is the toolkit that everyone needs. There is a one size fits all magic potion to this, which is why I feel it's really important that absolutes are sort of left out of the perimenopause, menopause conversation, because it can alienate women if they hear people saying, well, this is the best way to lose belly fat. And actually, it's really not helped. It's made, you know, the situation worse for that human. And so I think it's really important that we accept that because of our divine, wonderful complexity as women, perimenopause and menopause can be really complicated. And there is no simple solution that is going to work for everybody. And those solutions need to be individualized. I've got some women who come in and they have gone through their early 50s, but their periods have stopped and they've got a couple of hot flushes that are disrupting them during the daytime, and maybe disrupting their sleep a little bit at night, but otherwise are really well. And they just, you know, there are strategies that will work for those women that might include HRT, that might include looking at their diet, reducing alcohol consumption, exercising more, thinking about stress management. And that's probably going to be relatively straightforward. On the other end of the spectrum, we have more complex cases of women who might have a number of underlying, pre-existing medical issues like endometriosis or rheumatoid arthritis or thyroid dysfunction or a previous malignancy that's required treatment and that has been traumatizing, and there's PTSD. And, you know, we do tend to be quite complex. And we know, actually, there's some pretty good research to suggest that the perimenopause, menopause experience tends to be more severe in those women who have experienced severe trauma. And that's not necessarily big T trauma. It can sometimes be cumulative small T trauma, these kind of microaggressions that people have experienced throughout their lives. And obviously there is huge cultural differences between the microaggressions that different cultures have experienced throughout their lifetimes. And so it ends up being this kind of really massive sort of huge scale range of experiences. And it's about having time to listen to a woman who tells you their story, to pick out the important elements that we can address either through lifestyle change or through medication or pharmacological intervention, holding space for them, being supportive, and allowing things to be okay. You know, a lot of the time we are under all these pressures that we must be perfect and one must be okay all the time. And actually, I think this is a time of life where we can say, you know, it is going to be hard for some people. It's going to be harder for some people than others. And that's okay. But it's really important that you seek help and advice, because it doesn't need to feel horrible. It doesn't need to feel awful. So I know that's not a specific example, but I suppose I really just want to demonstrate how there is just such a breadth of experiences. And really the take home is, what works for your friend may not be the right solutions for you. Actually, what's really important is thinking about the whole range of tools that you've got available and finding what works best for you in your own personal toolkit. And that's going to look at stress management, sleep management, diet, gut health, movement, as well as HRT or MHT for some people. Or if that's not an option and medical intervention is still required, then things like antidepressant medications or oxybutynin, gabapentin, there are a number of other medicines that aren't HRT that can be really helpful at this phase.
Yeah, it's so rich, isn't it? And there's so much power in us sharing our stories, and yet each of our experiences is so individual that we can't, make assumptions or assume that what's right for us is going to work for someone else. And the other thing I heard when you were saying that was that that essentially this journey that we're on, you know, there's no blame, because even if we're living really well, we're eating well, we think we're doing the right things, what you're actually seeing is a huge diversity of women with different lifestyles coming in who may all have terrible symptoms. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot we can do, but you know, there's nothing that we're doing wrong necessarily that's causing the symptoms to happen.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think there needs to be no shame. There needs to be no blame. And I think that, you know, I don't like the term menopause. It's, you know, there's something, it's not a very positive word. But I think one positive that you can take from it is pause, and actually take this as an opportunity to stop and to let life kind of simmer around you for a little while and for you to start internally thinking, what works best for me? What are my priorities? What do I need to do here in order to live the life I want to lead positively with purpose, you know, into my future? And that can be, that is going to be different for everyone.
Yes. Fionnuala, where can people find out more about your work?
So I have a small sort of information platform on Instagram. So you can follow me at The Menopause Medic. I'm also dabbling in TikTok, so please come and join me there if you like TikTok. Again, it's the same handle, at The Menopause Medic. I have a website, themenopausemedic.com, and I can consult one-to-one patients who have a registered address in the UK, and we see patients across the UK via video consultations. And then I have a clinic in Hertfordshire, which is just north of London, where I see people face-to-face. And yeah, I'm hoping that by speaking in events like this, the small work that I do on the ground actually amplifies, and we can reach a much broader audience to allow as many women as possible to benefit and feel back in control and feel empowered through this stage of life, rather than feeling disempowered and, you know, out of control and unable to find a path forward.
Well, you certainly have empowered us with so much information today. Thank you.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Annie.